This week on Making Contact.
I can imagine that it may well have been considered very patriotic to have had a nuclear explosion in your state.
We don't want our people to die from all the dust that would fly out, so we start writing letters.
Nuclear bombs in the hands of terrorists is frightening enough, but imagine your own government blowing them up near your hometown. What would it do to your community, to your family? How would you react? And could anything be done to stop it from happening in the first place? On this edition, we'll hear how the world's most powerful weapons shaped the identity of two rural communities in the United States during the 1960s. One, a small town in southern Mississippi, the other, a native village in the land of the midnight sun, Alaska. I'm Tina Rubio, your host this week on Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. When you think of nuclear tests conducted by the United States during the Cold War, you might imagine mushroom clouds somewhere out in the desert or maybe on a small island in the Pacific Ocean. You might not associate nuclear testing with the Deep South. But in the mid-1960s, that's exactly where the U.S. exploded two atomic bombs, about 30 miles outside of Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Most of the information about Project Dribble is still classified. That's especially frustrating to the people who live near the test site today, and many believe their friends and relatives have gotten cancer as a result of radiation from the underground explosions. As correspondent Andrew Stelzer found when he went to Lamar County, Mississippi, the pair of nuclear tests has become a defining episode for local residents, many of whom have come to accept that their questions may never be answered.
That's all that conversation was around here. You didn't want to talk about Salt Dome, you didn't talk.
James Lowe has lived in Baxterville, Mississippi since he was a year old. He and his wife Dorothy have lived in the house he built on Tatum Salt Dome Road for the past 28 years. On the morning of October 22, 1964, he listened to a countdown on the radio for what became known as the Salmon Event, a nuclear test with an estimated yield between 5 and 8 kilotons, 2,700 feet underground in a salt dome on land owned by the Tatum family. Dorothy also listened to the countdown as she drove 7 miles to her mother's house.
I just did make it to the backyard at her house, and we were standing out there, and when it exploded, of course, there was a few seconds reprieve, and then the ground just like a wave of water, the ground we were standing on. So I know it damaged some houses. It cracked their foundation, you know, and the chimneys and this, that, and the other. I knew it had to, the way the ground rippled, just like a wave of water, just like a wave.
Where I was at, you could hear the leaves rattling on the trees.
Everyone in Baxterville seems to have a story about where they were that Thursday and how they later went down to Ground Zero to see the plaque marking the spot above the underground test site.
You could feel the ground quiver that day.
Grace Burge went on a picnic the day of the salmon test. She was one of the local residents forced by the government to evacuate the area. It's not just the day of the test that people talk about. They also have stories about what came later. Cancer.
My husband's mother died with bone cancer, and our best friends down here, both of them died with cancer. I have a brother-in-law has had cancer. Just about everybody in this area out here, one form or another, has had cancer. And there's a lot of younger people now getting it.
Salmon wasn't the only underground nuclear test the community had to endure. 2 years later, in 1966, another smaller bomb was detonated inside the cavern created by the Salmon test. That test was codenamed the Sterling Event. The Burges still live a mile and a half from Ground Zero and have a general store next to their home. Grace says anyone thinking about moving into the area should be told about the test before they buy a house. While home sellers might not be eager to inform prospective buyers, ask around town and you'll start to get the picture.
Like a big wave coming up underground.
Yeah, sort of like the waves in the ocean. You know how
as if it'd be underground.
Do like this.
The ground moved, rolled. I mean, just rolled.
Timmy Gibson was 9 years old at the time of the salmon test. He says it made a ripple in the road a foot high. Gibson has suffered from lymphoma, a cancer affecting the lymphatic system, but he isn't bothering to look into whether his sickness may have been brought on by the nuclear tests.
What can you do? Government, what can you do? You might be upset, but what you gonna do with the government, you know? You ain't gonna get no answer.
Gibson's attitude is typical among the people of Baxterville, suspicious that the tests have caused cancers in the area, yet feeling like there's nothing they can do about it. According to the Department of Energy, the two underground tests did not release radioactive particles into the atmosphere, but during drilling to prepare for the second test and other activities around the site, radioactive solid and liquid waste were generated, which contaminated the surface and shallow groundwater. James Lowe, who worked at the site operating a drill rig after the salmon test, says he witnessed some of those incidents.
I worked on the rig floor, and if any water liquid got down that, it'd come back steam, and it was radioactive. And you could take that Geiger counter and go around and find hot stuff all over the place around there.
Bob Goff, Director of Radiological Health at the Mississippi Department of Health, says the department has regularly tested for radiation at the site since 1974 and hasn't measured levels above natural background radiation. The health department has found unsafe levels of tritium, a radioisotope of hydrogen that's a byproduct of nuclear explosions, in the water at Ground Zero. Goff says this declined over the years and now meets the EPA's standards. But he doesn't know anything about the water quality before 1974.
The site was restricted. Yes, there was tritium levels above the Safe Drinking Water Act, but we've seen those decayed. The site had limited access, and there was no threat to the public health.
But the public wasn't convinced, and it was that unease that struck Bill Bishop when he returned to the area in 1972. Bishop grew up only a mile from Ground Zero, but was living in Jacksonville, Florida during the two tests. He heard stories about the explosions and came back to find the community had nowhere to go with their questions and were potentially putting themselves in danger.
They had some gates or gaps there, but they really, really, the place wasn't secure. You would find typical construction underway signs out there. Keep out, no trespassing, et cetera, but the community was able to come and go without anyone saying anything. We used to chase rabbits out there with our little beagle dogs. We'd shoot rabbits all around Ground Zero.
20 years later, Bishop was elected to the Lamar County Board of Supervisors and began pressuring the federal government to pay for a drinking water system so that people living near the Salt Dome wouldn't have to drink well water anymore. His request kept getting rejected, but finally, in 1999, after 5 years of discussion, the Energy Department allocated just under $2 million to pay for a drinking water system 3 or 4 miles from Ground Zero that would pipe water to residents living near the site.
We had a 5-mile radius that we felt like should be taken care of because we had already done some engineering surveys in the area, and the majority of the people that were concerned lived within a 5-mile area around Ground Zero. We presented that. DOE came back, said, no, that's too big an area. We don't want to fund 5 miles. We want to fund 2.5 miles. So get your engineer to redraw it and shrink it up some. But we argued and argued and argued and argued. And we finally got a few residences on the water system once it was finally built, maybe a little bit outside the 2.5 mile area. But we never did get the 5 mile area that we had originally requested. It was a tough battle.
Bishop thinks the federal government installed the new water system to placate the community, which to some extent has worked, but it's also fueled suspicions that there's something wrong with the water.
If the radiation is contained underground and absorbed through a thick layer of earth, then it should in principle pose no threat to life or humans above the ground.
Grayson Rayborn is Professor Emeritus of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Southern Mississippi. Rayborn says that salt domes are understood to be stable structures, which should stay sealed unless a crack is somehow created.
If the salt dome were breached, then that would be a possible way for radiation to come out.
Ann and Steve Bounds run the gas station at the intersection of State Road 13 and Butler Road, about 4 miles from the test site. Steve's father was a truck driver who hauled the bomb in a few days before the salmon test.
You know, he told me that they were going to shoot it off.
But even, I don't think they even believed it'd be as big as what it was.
Steve Bounds' father died of leukemia in 1987 at the age of 57. Although his dad never said whether he thought he got sick because of the test, Steve and his 4 siblings have filed a claim with the government to try and get compensated for their father's death.
I filed something about a year or so ago, but they had never determined nothing or let me know nothing.
Many other area residents have filed claims, and despite a rumor that one was actually paid, no one knows who, if anyone, was ever compensated. Despite testing a private and public water supplies for over 30 years, Bob Goff from the State Department of Health says he would not drink the water at Ground Zero, and he says the monitoring program will go on indefinitely.
We're reasonably sure that the tritium levels are going to continue to decline. We feel reasonably certain that there will be no off-site radioactivity, but we want to have that insurance there that through our monitoring program that that does not happen.
As to why Mississippi was chosen for nuclear testing, the most common explanation given for the site of the tests is the presence of the underground salt domes, which are relatively rare. But that doesn't satisfy Ann Bounds.
You know, that's the main question. Why would they do it here? Back then, it wasn't as populated, but
there were still folks living by.
Professor Rayborn says he's still not sure himself.
It may have benefited weapons makers, but not the scientific community. Always seemed to me an anomaly that needed more understanding. Why did those tests happen here in this state when the preponderance of the tests were done at a much better instrumented site far away?
Rayborn says he doesn't think the government could get away with conducting a nuclear test in the area today, but the 1960s were a different time.
From the 21st century, it doesn't look very clever at all, but, I mean, the nuclear blast had, quote, won the war, end quote. They demoralized Japan. And I can imagine that it may well have been considered very patriotic to have had a nuclear explosion in your state.
The land at Ground Zero has been transferred to the state of Mississippi, and the area has been designated a demonstration forest and wildlife refuge, in the state's words, to ensure that there are no unacceptable exposures to human health and the environment. In February of 2000, County Supervisor Bill Bishop got a congressional award for his efforts to get a water system installed near the test site. He's proud of what he's done, but still worried about the people who live nearby. His biggest fear is that they've been right about the cancers all along.
There was lots of unfounded speculation, but some of those people that were speculating may have been closer to the truth than they really realized about what will eventually evolve out of this thing.
Reporting for Making Contact, near Ground Zero in Lamar County, Mississippi, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
Coming up in a few moments,
bury an inline series of four equally spaced 100 kiloton shots at a depth of 30 meters. Detonate.
An unusual plan by the U.S. government, using nuclear weapons to alter the Earth's surface. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information, or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. After World War II, Americans closely associated the newly invented atomic bomb with victory over Japan. But not long after the U.S. dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, destroying both cities and killing hundreds of thousands of people, it became clear just how destructive nuclear weapons are, and Americans started having second thoughts about them. In response, scientists and government officials set about putting a happy face on nuclear technology, promising that the atom would do more than just win wars. It would improve people's lives. But they didn't always tell the whole story, as one group of Alaskans found out. Correspondent Gabriel Spitzer has more on the U.S. plan to turn its swords into plowshares.
The late 1950s were a time of great optimism about America's bright nuclear future. Scientists imagined everything from free electricity to efficient space travel, all thanks to the atom.
The great and violent power of nuclear explosion can be used for peaceful purposes.
That's the voice of the late Edward Teller, known as Father of the H-Bomb, taken from an early 1960s Atomic Energy Commission film. The program to use nuclear weapons for peaceful purposes, called Project Plowshare, envisioned using atomic bombs to blast out canals, reshape coastlines, and literally move mountains.
It was really an episode of tremendous scientific hubris.
Dan O'Neill of Fairbanks, Alaska, is the author of The Firecracker Boys, which chronicles the events that would bring Project Plowshare to the Arctic.
The idea that you could almost reenact creation and decide which parts would be land and which parts would be water, with very little thought or care or attention to the consequences, environmental or towards human health.
We are ridding our tools for the association with radioactive danger.
Historians now say Plowshare existed largely to give the bomb a PR makeover, to rally an increasingly skeptical public around stepping up the arms race. Plus, Plowshare's advocates wanted a way to get around agreements with the Soviets to strictly limit nuclear testing. This was a way for the military to keep advancing the technology of nuclear war, without looking like it was rattling its saber. Nevertheless, boosters like Edward Teller couch the program in humanitarian terms.
At the very outset, we were convinced of one thing. The most interesting thing that we might find out may be something which no one expects, a surprise.
Plowshare would prove to be a big surprise to one group in particular, the Inupiaq Eskimos of Point Hope, a small village on the far northwest corner of Arctic Alaska. People have lived in Point Hope for at least 2,000 years, hunting the bowhead whale and subsisting off the land and the ocean. Inupiaq elder Dorcas Rock recalls the locals' first inkling that something was going on at Cape Thompson, about 30 miles down the coast.
It's because of the hunters seeing unusual things, and late at night we would see lights flickering over towards that area, and we knew that it had to be something fishy going on.
At the mouth of Ogotoric Creek, smack in the middle of Point Hope's prime hunting grounds, the U.S. government was planning to blow up as many as 6 thermonuclear bombs. The idea was to excavate a deep water harbor in a matter of seconds. They called it Project Chariot. Planning had begun in 1958. By 1960, Teller and others had taken multiple trips to Alaska to sell the project. They argued a harbor would have great economic benefits for Alaska, providing a way to export hypothetical resources that may one day be extracted in the region. Evidence would later suggest that these claims were wildly overblown, and that the real reasons had more to do with showing it could be done. The project gained wide support from politicians, business leaders, and newspapers, but no one from the Atomic Energy Commission, or AEC, had gotten around to telling the people of Point Hope, just 30 miles from Ground Zero. Originally, Chariot would involve 2.4 megatons of nuclear explosives, about 160 times the blast that destroyed Hiroshima. Dan O'Neill gives some idea of just how big that is.
It would have been equivalent to loading one-ton flatbed trucks to their legal limit with dynamite, and it would take a convoy to be equivalent to Chariot. The convoy would stretch from Fairbanks to southern Argentina, bumper to bumper. So something like 40% of all the firepower expended in World War II, you know, touched off in an instant.
At last, in March of 1960, 3 AEC representatives arrived in Point Hope. With the villagers assembled, they turned off the lights and showed them a film called Industrial Applications of Nuclear Explosives.
The potential applications? Consider just one. The development of a harbor in the hard rock of a remote coastal area. Bury an inline series of 4 equally spaced 100 kiloton shots at a depth of 30 meters. And a terminal
on the screen, an animated picture of Cape Thompson appeared. A keyhole-shaped dotted line showed where the harbor would go.
Detonate.
In a puff of cartoonish smoke, the Green Valley became part of the ocean. Villagers asked pointed questions about the risks. Records show that the answers they got were, in many cases, demonstrably false. Dan O'Neill.
The group, what they told the people was simply untrue as to the effects of radiation, as to the history of nuclear testing and its effect on people, the effect on Japanese survivors of the two bombings over there. The whole presentation was just riddled with inaccuracies and, I would argue, deliberate lies.
Lack of information and repeated half-truths fueled an atmosphere of fear and paranoia in the village. Point Hope Mayor George Kinyak was in high school at the time.
I was afraid and angry, plus we were afraid they were trying to wipe out the Inupiaq that was in the Arctic, because we're the only Native people throughout the United States who has never been conquered by the United States or have war against the United States. That's one of the feelings what we have, that they were going to try to wipe us out because they never did beat us in war.
The government had told the people of Point Hope they would hardly notice all those nuclear bombs exploding down the coast. But villagers weren't buying it. 83-year-old Alice Weber was a health worker at the time.
After they leave, we talked about the things that would come out of the bomb. We don't want our people to die from all the dust that would fly out. It were not too far out. So we started writing letters.
Point Hope began to enlist sympathetic politicians, scientists, and activists. And for perhaps the first time in U.S. history, this group of natives began to have political influence. In 1961, they made a recording on reel-to-reel tape, registering their objections to Project Chariot. As the tape circulated, people expecting to hear a bunch of ignorant Eskimos were surprised at how savvy they really were.
I don't know much about the atomic bombs, but, well, it's just like taking a chance on our lives here at Point Hope.
Everybody in the village are against it.
We understood that the radiation on this atomic bomb, it may be harmful to both animals and the people.
What if something should go wrong? It is too late then.
Well, Jimmy, what do you think about nuclear tests? Do you like to see it blow up?
No, I don't like it.
Yeah, okay, Jimmy.
Meanwhile, a revelation emerged about the Arctic ecosystem. Lichens that blanket the Alaska tundra get most of their nutrients from the air. That makes them major repositories for radioactive fallout. Caribou eat the lichens. People eat the caribou, and the radioactive particles are transported up the food chain with remarkable efficiency. Author Dan O'Neill says that connection triggered a kind of eureka moment. Before, conservationists had tended to focus on preserving landscapes and endangered species. Chariot helped transform the conservationists into environmentalists, emphasizing the intimate connections among ecosystems.
That change of thinking really, I think, led the world in a change of thinking that established itself as the environmental movement. So it's kind of an interesting moment in history where this little episode way up in this extreme corner of the continent really did precipitate a major shift in human thinking.
Hooray! I'm a radioactive Eskimo with a radioactive mother, a radioactive sister, and a radioactive brother.
The native struggle was memorialized in a 1961 protest tune by American Indian folk singer Peter Lafarge.
When we eat the caribou, the moss the caribou eats is rained on good by the dirty rain. It's radioactive meat. I'm a radioactive Eskimo with a radioactive mother, a radioactive sister, and a radioactive brother.
In the summer of 1962, the government pulled the plug on Project Chariot. It was a huge victory for the Point Hope Eskimos. But as Elder Alice Weber recalls, the story wasn't over yet.
Behind us, they did something, though. They go right ahead and put that bomb right by the beach, which would hurt us.
What she's referring to was about 44 pounds of irradiated dirt hauled up from the Nevada nuclear test site and a Denver laboratory. In 1962, after Chariot had been foiled, the dirt was buried at Cape Thompson and studied as it ran off into the creek. Again, no one told the villagers, and there it remained until it was discovered 30 years later. It was finally cleaned up in 1993.
This graveyard is still being used today. This site being the oldest site.
Point Hope resident Steve Umituk walks through the village cemetery. Important graves are marked with curved whale jawbones, up to 15 feet high. Umituk says many people here died from a disease virtually unknown in this area 100 years ago.
We had a high rate of cancer. Then a lot of it is stomach cancer, colon cancer.
Cancer cases in Point Hope went up dramatically in the 1970s. People here watched with growing alarm as one villager after another got sick.
My father died of cancer in 83. He's buried over here. And then the Project Chariot came out of the nuclear waste that they buried over there, and people hunted and lived over there. My grandparents were raised over there at Cape Thompson. There's a lot of issues that, a lot of classified stuff that need to be just declassified.
It's not clear whether the 44 pounds of radioactive material buried near Point Hope directly harmed people. Dan O'Neill says villagers were justifiably outraged, but probably not at risk.
So in every way, it was disrespectful and illegal and improper. But I don't think it had the potential, you know, 30 years out, buried under 4 feet of dirt, 30 miles from the nearest dwelling, to hurt anybody.
In the mid-90s, Dr. Bruce Bowerman conducted an epidemiological study of cancer in Point Hope for the North Slope Borough, the area's regional government. He found that cancer rates there were indeed higher than in the population at large. Bowerman looked at 10 risk factors for cancer, including smoking, a family history of cancer, and working at the Project Chariot site. None seemed to correlate with higher incidence of the disease.
The only one that really popped out as significant was the fact of the people living in Point Hope in the year 1962, where it was documented that there were higher levels of radioisotopes in the general environment during that area.
So just being there in the early 60s meant one was more likely to get cancer. Some of that may have to do with fallout from atmospheric nuclear testing conducted by both the U.S. and the Soviets. People in Point Hope believe that much of it has to do with activities surrounding Chariot. But the sample size available in the study was so small, 24 cancer cases in 23 people over 3 decades, that the results are highly uncertain. It's nearly impossible to get more reliable data, and in general, lifestyle plays a much bigger role in cancer cases than environmental contaminants. But Bowerman says the study still raises questions.
You look at the two numbers and you say, wow, there's a lot of cancer here. But then you look at the small number of people in the village, there's not statistical significance with that. But it's a higher number, and it would raise one's eyebrows as far as, hey, there's something going on here.
The uncertainty surrounding what did happen near Point Hope has left the people living there today, even public servants like Mayor George Kingick, deeply skeptical about the government.
We have no trust with the government. Our trust has been gone a long time ago because of Project Chariot with the government. We have no trust.
Residents like Alice Weber shudder to think how close they came and what life might be like if Edward Teller and others had had their way.
Maybe no hardly people. So many people died from cancer after. So I don't know what it would be like. No Point Hope.
But Chariot's legacy is also one of empowerment. A small group of disenfranchised Native people managed to turn back a powerful government agency in the midst of the Cold War. The fight against Chariot also got people asking questions about their land. Who owned it? Who had the right to do what on it? Alaska Natives began to rally around demands to resolve their ancient claims on the land. 9 years after Chariot went down in flames, Natives won the largest land claim settlement in U.S. history. They regained about 44 million acres of land, still a fraction of what they once occupied, and nearly $1 billion. Thanks in part to Project Chariot, the indigenous people of Alaska found a political voice and got back some of what they lost when the white men came. For Making Contact, I'm Gabriel Spitzer in Anchorage, Alaska.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to Dan Turner and Ronald Rucker. For a CD copy of program number 1206, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or go to radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Justin Beck, producer, Dorian Taylor, communications manager, Esther Mania, outreach coordinator, and Tom Evans, development associate. And I'm Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.